So I'm talking to Sid Rodriguez of Skeptics in the Pub. I've spoken to Norman and Carmen before, had their take on the history. Tell me how you got involved then.
Well, I was studying at King's College, just down the road from here in Waterloo, and I was actually quite interested in this from a lot further back. So I was really interested in like Paul Daniels and magic and things like that.
Oh, okay.
And I was a big fan of Paul Daniels. So I basically like became a prepubescent magician for a lot of my life. And then there was a guy called Uri Geller who basically said that he could basically bend spoons by the power of his mind.
I've heard of him, I've seen pictures.
And there was someone else called James Randi who was a debunker from the United States. And he had a television program in the 1980s that was called James Randi Psychic Investigator. And my parents are quite religious parents, and they actually used to, you know, every time Uri Geller was on TV, they'd get their old broken watches out of the drawers and stuff and say, you know, this guy, he can basically make watches come back to life and things like that. And, you know, you have to hold them and watch the television, and then his psychic powers would come in and by magic.
Okay. What religion were your parents?
They're Goan Christians.
Goan, okay.
So they're from India originally. And my dad came over in like, sort of the 1960s with my mum.
Catholic.
Catholic, yeah. That's hence the surname, having a Rodriguez surname.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're very devout Catholics, so yeah, we're known around the area for being part of the church and things like that for many, many years. In a very middle class area where most people were probably not religious, or probably secular, to be fair. So from going from like Paul Daniels and my parents believing in Uri Geller, I basically tried to find a bit of the middle way. So I learned to be a magician and find out how people trick other people.
Okay.
At the same time, my parents are basically saying that, you know, miracles do happen. So there was a bit of a fork in the road to a certain extent. Yeah. It's like, well, either it's true or either it's not.
Yeah.
And because I'm a bit of a nerd and I really like to find out how stuff works, so I'm more of a scientist or engineer type of brain.
Is that what you studied at? Engineering?
I went to university. Well, my best A levels were, I did A levels at school. I was always into like the science and how stuff works. But it's quite easy if you're in a certain setting to basically say that religion has nothing to do with science and keep those two separate. So you can actually become a very good, you know, scientist. But still believing in in
silos. You know, keep your thinking in silos.
Yeah, so it's almost siloed. But because of this program that was on, I think it was ITV at the time, where they were testing psychics, and I believed in all of those psychics and fairies, and because my parents did, and they're basically saying this actually happens. And when James Randi basically had this show and they tested all of these things and said, well, this is how you scientifically test a supernatural phenomena in a scientific way, it was massively groundbreaking for me, because I was only probably maybe 12, 13, 14 at the time, and there was this television program basically telling me about the scientific method and how it actually works on a daily basis. So you don't basically say that this is right and this is wrong. What you actually do is you basically say that we think this may be right, this may be wrong. How do you test that hypothesis? And this is the first time I heard of what a hypothesis is. And then you make a test for it. And the test is usually very easy. It's like, you know, everyone learns at school about flipping a coin and having a 50-50 aspect of it. And it's like, how do you prove over, without a reasonable doubt, I would say, you know, it comes into law as well, that this is either true or not true. And that's how I used to think, because I used to think that everything was either true or not true. I didn't actually realise that there's a big grey area in between about, you know, there's a whole demarcation of what is true and what not true. So over time, I actually realised that you can prove, or you can disprove that something happens, but you can't prove that anything happens. Mm. And if you're trying to prove something, you can only do it to a certain degree. And so from being an amateur conjurer in my young days, and then moving through how people think and how the world works, I've actually sort of come to the realisation that, you know, you can basically disprove stuff, but you can never prove that anything's true. And anything in between is always going to be a grey area. And you can always work to basically push these grey areas either to either being more true or less true.
Okay. So that's the basic philosophy of the skeptics in the pub, you'd say?
Well, I think it is, yeah, because I think before with the skeptics, everything was black and white. And there are lots of things that are black and white, but I think to convince people, you basically have to show your working like you would do on a GCSE maths paper or a biology paper or a history paper,
yeah,
as a 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old child.
So,
and if you can't convince people who are in between 11 and 15 of what your theory is, then you've probably done a bad job. And that applies to everyone,
yeah,
not just skeptics or scientists, yeah, or teachers or historians. It applies to everyone.
So would you say the work of the skeptics in the pub is to convince people or to encourage?
If there's one thing I actually know is that people are convinced by their own arguments. So what you have to do is basically give all the arguments, and then people have to convince other people of how good their arguments are or not. And this is one of the things that skepticism in America and Australia and other first world countries haven't really realised. The UK is a very different aspect of it. So when I sort of was involved in skepticism in the UK, the US basically had a big sort of properly organised, you know, with lots of professors and things and lots of important people who are, you know, these are the people who you need to go to if you want to talk about this. If you went to Australia, there was a guy who basically gave $1 million to set up a skeptics organisation to do exactly the same thing that was in the States. But in the UK, there were very few people. So if you look at it as a population-wise, you know, maybe like in the US, when people used to buy magazines or go to websites and things, there was a very high hit rate on what people would be brought to those type of media. And in Australia, it was the same. And they'd basically have like publicity people, and they'd have marketing people, and they'd have scientists, and they have a big pool of people who basically happy to talk to the media. But when it came to the UK, the only people that were really on the list of people who would turn up as skeptics were two people. So one would be Chris French, and the other one would be Richard Wiseman. They were the only two people in the UK basically doing anything about skepticism.
Okay. And you're saying it's more organised now?
No, I think in the UK, the way people don't really understand how it is being a British person and things, and we can be very organised or very disorganised, but I think we have better bullshit detectors than a lot of people. So if you think of how we have a national religion, in effect. So, in effect, if you're born and no one gives you religion, you're automatically Church of England.
Yeah.
Because the Queen is the head of state, who's unelected, and then all the other unelected people who are probably lords would be the next ones down, all the earls, and so we basically have a very historic clusterfuck, I think would be the best. Yeah, I think a clusterfuck. So, clusterfuck. So lots of people own land and things that no one ever knows, and it's not like, yeah. And the way that the system works is very archaic, and in those boundaries of having this archaic world, which is a microcosm of how the world works. So we've got 65 million people in the UK. The population of the Earth at the moment has breached 8 billion, I think, this year. So we're a very small part of it, but we still think we have an empire, and we still have certain quirks about how we think the world works, which works in our favour as well as our detriment, because no one believes everyone else, which is scepticism. It's enteric in quite a lot of aspects of it, and I think the British people basically are quite
skeptical
generally.
Yeah.
And you're not forced to basically do anything. Yeah. I think. Are we forced to do anything? Yes. I've got to think about this. We probably are forced to do some things, have unelected bishops in the House of Lords or whatever. You know. Mm. Have magic wand people and unicorns and so on that aspect, but we're quite pragmatic in another sense, where we're a very small island, but we have very good scientists, and we have people like, you know, your Richard Dawkins, and we have quite a lot of philosophers. Yeah, Bertrand Russell was actually part of the landed gentry, and he basically told them that they're talking bollocks. But because he was part of the landed gentry, he could do what he fucking liked. Yeah. So you have all these different weird aspects that would probably only happen in these small isles that we are actually on, as opposed to somewhere that's a bit more regimented. So I'd say France is quite regimented. They're very secular in a certain extent. But they're quite mad at the same time.
The Jilly Johns would be the latest evidence of that. That the Yellow Jackets, they call them Jilly Johns.
A certain revolution.
Revolutionary.
A certain revolution to a certain extent. So it's, you know, there's a lot of, you know, we live in interesting times, and I'd rather leave that to. It'd be an interesting thing for the skeptics, because I think it's something the skeptics can actually cover. Because the aspect about skeptics in the farm is, like, a lot of people, you know, we had a lot of science talks, because I'm from a science background, so I thought that was quite interesting.
Which sciences?
I basically worked for 10 years in molecular biology, so I worked from everything from the National DNA Database for forensic science to DNA... I can go through the whole things, actually. I'll go through the whole career. So I started off doing data entry, actually, for the National DNA Database, which is, like, if you're arrested, they take a DNA swab, and they can match up with a criminal sample somewhere down the line. And then I moved over to doing parrot sexing. So parrots... With birds, it's quite difficult to basically breed rare breed parrots. So, you know, the African greys, the ones that Everyone wants these parrots called African greys. There's certain parrots that people like. The African greys are the ones that people want, because they're the ones that do impressions of different vehicles. And, you know, if you pick up the... You know, they're very good at imitating stuff. And because they're rare breeds, people have ones that they've actually bred in the UK. But because there's only such a small population, to breed them, you have to work out what sex they are, because... You can't tell the sex of them by looking at them.
Okay.
So what you have to do is you have to yank out one of their feathers and hope there's enough DNA on in the feather, and then extract the DNA. Because they're not... They don't have X and Y chromosomes like mammals have. They have a different... They're more related to lizards and things. So they have a different setup. So you have to work out whether one's a male or female from a slightly different chromosome setup to how mammals work. And then, if you're lucky, you can basically try and get these two parrots that are of opposite sexes together. And then hopefully...
They haven't got penises and vaginas?
No.
Nothing equivalent.
No, No, it's a bit complicated. It's a bit more complicated than that. So yeah, the easiest way is to yank out feathers, try and do DNA tests on them, and then work out whether one's male or one's female, and then get two strange individuals in a room, and hope that they're mate to basically give you another rare breed of parrot that you basically can't nick from a forest in wherever they're from. So poaching and all these things for animals is quite a big thing. You know, loads of people have weird. There are loads of stories about weird panthers wandering around Bodmin Moor and all that stuff.
Okay.
So that was the next job. So I'll come back to. And then I moved into genotyping.
Hey, is that my wine?
Yeah, I think that is your wine. The table got a bit wobbly, so it's everything was.
No, I have the projector.
Oh,
sorry.
I thought
I'd play this. I'm so sorry.
I've
interrupted your.
No.
We're still. Yeah, I'm basically like going through my life story.
Oh, do you still need me? I feel like I've contributed my.
No, that's right. I just wanted to wrap up. I just wanted to wrap up the link for you, Conway. So you were with Conway Hall first, and then Skeptics. Or did you?
Well, no, I was on Skeptics first, and then because I was working as a scientist at the time in lots of varied areas.
You were a forensic scientist, weren't you?
I basically have worked in so many different weird areas. So the company I was working for did lots of different forensic areas and other areas and stuff. And then after the 2007 crash, we all got our marching orders. And so I hung in there for another 5 years because I worked there for so long, I knew how all the departments worked and what bits need to be done. So they just farmed me around, and then it came to probably 2008, 2009, and then they basically said, you know, you're finally being moved to a different area and, you know, you're no longer there. So I had to find out what else to do. So I volunteered for Conway Hall. And in the end, one of the people who was doing all the events and stuff left to become a primary school teacher, and then I took that place. And I've been there ever since, so.
Okay. All right. Well, I think I've got quite a bit to work with.
Usually people don't ask me to do interviews because I just fuck them up.
No, no.